How do minorities, minority groups, castes, genders, religions access the state and the state's services? My name is Siddharth Swaminathan. I'm a political scientist by training. The collaboration between Brown University and Janagraha is essentially aimed at identifying, well, what contributes to citizenship, what forms the basis for citizenship, and does higher levels of citizenship lead to better provision of public services within urban governments. So we have to deal with multiple aspects in terms of what is citizenship, how do we measure citizenship, what are the public services that local governments provide, and what are the dynamics involved in the provision of these services. More importantly, I think one of the things that this project is trying to understand is what is the relationship between individuals and the state and different kinds of individuals, meaning does religion matter? Do specific religious groups or people from specific religions, do they have an easier time or a harder time accessing the state? Okay. The same with caste. Do specific caste groups have easier or much tougher time in accessing the state, in accessing public services? So we have these three components. One is voting, one is civic, and the third one is social discrimination. So these are the three components of citizenship that we're focusing on. So we're using this to come up with a measure of citizenship.
That was Siddharth Swaminathan, a political scientist at the Institute for Social and Economic Change in Bangalore. He's part of a team of Brown University scholars embarking on a new research project to measure citizenship in urban India.
In partnership with Janagraha, a civil society organization based in Bangalore, they're implementing a survey to examine how various groups claim and exercise citizenship in urban contexts.
As Indian cities continue to swell in size, the Brown India Initiative hopes to produce research that will help planners and leaders understand the challenges facing urban citizens, and in turn, build strong, dynamic, and inclusive cities.
Sociologist Patrick Heller is instrumental to the citizenship project. He's a professor at Brown University and a lifelong scholar of India. We started by asking him about caste.
I remember very well from your reference to this Carla Hoff study in UP, where she administered a test to a classroom of school children and took all the results and then repeated the test, but before giving out the test, announced everyone's name and caste and found in the results that the Dalits performed significantly worse than they had initially. And it's just boggling how, from that example, how psychologically ingrained caste is and how you carry it inside of yourself, regardless of your ability, even as a child. How is the survey that is set to span 8 cities going to measure caste and the consciousness of caste and indeed aspiration amongst caste?
I have to begin by pointing out that the Carla Hoff study was based on similar studies done in the U.S., where they found exactly the same results with respect to race. And I think what those findings underscore is a much broader and unfortunately much more universal phenomenon, is that inequality is deeply ingrained. So inequality is obviously built into your economic system. It's built into your institutions. And it's built into people's own understandings of themselves and their ability to aspire, right? So the Indian anthropologist Arjuna Paduri talks about the capacity to aspire, which in and of itself is unevenly distributed across class, caste, and gender, right? So it's, you know, a woman who's trapped in the institution of Purda in rural UP does not aspire to be a professor. it's an unreasonable aspiration given material realities. But then it produces, of course, its own forms, kind of psychological disempowerment. So I think this is a universal phenomenon. We're not even trying to get to some of these deeper psychological issues because they're incredibly difficult to capture. What we're trying to do is get a better understanding of the institutional environment. So if you think of citizenship as the practice of using your rights, it's clear that the ability to use your rights has to do with the institutional settings in which you claim those rights. So obviously the Indian Constitution guarantees all Indians certain rights, the right to associate, the right to speak freely, the right to participate in elections. It also increasingly specifies certain social rights, the right to subsidize food if you're poor, the rights to services if you live within the jurisdiction of a city, etc. And what every citizen of urban India knows is that those rights are very unevenly distributed in practice, right? Depending on who you are and depending on where you live and depending on who you know, you are entitled to different levels of services. Obviously water, sanitation, and electricity, but also things like schooling, quality of healthcare, etc. So, you know, what the Citizenship Index is designed to do is try to understand in measurable ways how unevenly distributed those rights are and to what extent those differences, that unevenness, corresponds with social characteristics like caste, class, and religion, but also certain spatial characteristics, things like what in the US are called neighborhood effects. So by virtue of living in a certain neighborhood, a certain kind of slum or a certain kind of authorized or unauthorized colony, the neighborhood as a whole, almost independently of other of social and economic attributes, just doesn't get the same level of services as the neighboring neighborhood. So we all know, generally speaking, that there's a lot of unevenness across socioeconomic categories, across neighborhoods, but no one's actually ever measured this. So that's what we're trying to do with the citizenship survey.
That was Patrick Heller, a sociologist at Brown University and a visiting scholar at the Center for Policy Research in New Delhi. Next, we hear from Ramesh Ramanathan at Janagraha.
The population of Indian cities is constantly in flux and increasingly in flux. Thousands of people from outside of Karnataka are coming into Bangalore every day. How does this migration and this flux in population affect regional identity and therefore investment in local participation, public participation?
If I had to generalize, a city like Bangalore has traditionally not been a city of locals. So if you go back five, six, seven decades, you would find that local Kannadigas are no more than about a third of the city. And so it's been a city for a variety of reasons, which has seen migrants coming in from both other parts of the state, but significantly large numbers of people coming from outside the state as well. And that's been the nature of the state. And the composition of who these people are, what their professional backgrounds are, has obviously changed because of the changing economics of the city with the IT boom and so on. But that raises the question that you've asked, which is, how does one define identity and engagement and participation? This is a question that I think we certainly are grappling with, and I think it's an important question for other cities in India as well. Our conclusion is, it's important to understand, how does ownership come? How does a stake come in the city, irrespective of whether you belong originally to that city? Because in India, we do have porous borders, and we're going to see this flux go back and forth across cities in India. But how can we ensure that people feel that they have a stake and start engaging in the city? And very often, the language of that particular city tends to become a huge barrier, especially when it comes to engaging with formal institutions of the state. Because very often the conduct of business of the state is in the local language. And part of why we are trying to establish the Citizenship Index is to say, are there patterns that we can understand in terms of linguistic background, in terms of being a local or not a local? And that the implication of that on levels of civic understanding and engagement, levels of political understanding and engagement, and so on. Because if we understand those, then we can design interventions around them. But right now, we don't even have the data to know what the patterns are.
Individual instances of discrimination seem relatively rare in the city. But as a community, as a group, the community feels in some way victimized. So again, this is a hypothesis that is, I think, amenable to be for testing.
The other thing that's quite complicated, it seems, is measuring discrimination and yes. How people feel that. And perhaps it's also quite a foreign concept, this idea of knowing whether you're being discriminated against in those terms.
Yeah, no, and this is something that's plagued survey data on these issues ever since people started trying to capture this dynamic. And it's incredibly difficult to do, and we know from the experience of sociological work in the United States that different measures of discrimination produce really different results, often quite contradictory results, that some groups are more willing to talk about discrimination than others, that what you're in fact just capturing is a political consciousness effect. In India, for example, Dalits probably have a much more developed vocabulary of discrimination than other groups for all the obvious reasons. So there's tremendous methodological issues, and we've struggled with these. But I think we've dealt with it in a fairly sophisticated way. We've consulted a lot of people. We've worked our way through all the existing relevant literature and survey instruments. But most importantly, we ran a pilot. And that pilot taught us a lot of things about which questions seem to work and which questions don't seem to work. What we did discover is that, by and large, people are reluctant to talk about discrimination. And I think there's a combination there of shame, not wanting to reveal that you're being mistreated, that you're a victim, etc. I think there's also, frankly, a certain amount of apprehension about talking to outsiders about what is a very politically loaded issue, maybe even fear of reprisal. But, you know, basically, we've decided or settled on a two-pronged strategy. One is to ask people a series of questions about how they generally perceive the treatment of their community, be it a caste community or a religious community, in that city as a whole, or in that community as a whole. So it's not a question directly about themselves. So hopefully that's doesn't come with the shame issues that asking the individual directly. But the second strategy has been to ask about experiences of discrimination. And there we're not even using the language of discrimination in and of itself. We're just taking people through a series of questions about their interactions with different state institutions, how they were treated, et cetera, how that treatment compares with how others they know might have been treated. And from there, we'll be able, we hope, to derive some experiential sense of what discrimination might be like.
To go to citizenship at its heart, you mentioned that earlier that no government is so proactive as to move before there is contestation in the public realm over things like patriarchy and other such issues. Where does citizenship begin? Is it a first mover issue where if the public conform and behave, so will the state? Or is it if the state respects public rights, so will the public?
Right. You can't have citizenship without both. I mean, citizens have to be empowered, and they have to be active, and they have to be willing, and they have to have a political conscience, and they have to be committed to each other and to the ideals of citizenship. On the other hand, the precondition for the exercise of citizenship is a state that enforces rights, basic rights of association, free speech, including protecting individuals not only from the state itself and arbitrary forms of power, but protecting individuals from each other, right? So protecting the vulnerable from the powerful, protecting women who are victimized from abusive husbands, etc. So the two are completely interdependent at some level, right? But at any specific moment in time and on any specific issue, there is always a first mover problem. So it's obvious, I think, that by and large, in terms of pushing the envelope on new issues that parties might be reluctant to take up because it might disturb their electoral calculations, etc., the state's usually pretty conservative, and it's up to movements to take the first move. And then if they're successful in problematizing it and projecting it into the public sphere, then parties might get sensitized to the issue and take it up in the next elections, etc. And then you get a cycle of transformation. So if you think about the women's movement, the environmental movement, civil rights movements, caste reform movements, that's usually the progression, right? So on some issues, the state's going to be the first mover. On generally the more contentious issues that have to do with changing norms and values, etc., it's usually citizens that are going to be the first movers.
Mm-hmm. So from my understanding, the interest in doing the Citizenship Index came from this very real possibility that in the next 15 years or so, half of India's population will be urban. Is this kind of urban migration completely inevitable? And should India be doing more to sort of stall it or prevent it?
It is inevitable, and India should do nothing to stall it or prevent it. First of all, in a historical comparative perspective, if anything, India is woefully under-urbanized. The comparative statistics on this aren't terribly reliable, but, you know, Brazil is 85% urban. You know, India is, I think, creeping up to 35%. China's much higher. And there's both a push and a pull factor. The push factor is that agriculture is just stagnating. And, it's been growing at about 2% a year. And land fragmentation in India is already acute. The average farm holding in India is absolutely tiny. And with each generation, you're splitting it up more and more, and it becomes less and less viable. So the existing population that has to eke an existence off of the rural land is unsustainable, right? So even if you had vast increases in agricultural productivity, the demographics suggest that more and more people will leave agriculture. But then there's just a pull factor. Rightly or wrongly, Ambedkar famously said, rural India is a den of nasty, I forget the exact quote, but it was a mean, nasty, inhospitable place, especially for lower caste groups. I think there's a tendency to exaggerate how free the city is and how quickly those traditional hierarchies of caste and gender and other dependencies dissolve in the context of the city. But clearly there's more anonymity in the city, there's more mobility, there's more associational freedom. And as media and TV and cell phones and the internet have started to penetrate rural areas, just the fact that rural populations are now exposed to these images of urban life, I think, is becoming a huge pull factor. So I think it's inevitable. There's only one way to control the rate of urbanization, and that's authoritarianism. China did it successfully in apartheid. South Africa did it successfully. India can't do that. It would be a bad idea, and I think it would be bad policy. So urbanization is going to happen. It's probably going to begin to happen at an increasingly higher rate because of these just simple demographic pressures in rural areas and the unequal level of economic growth between rural and urban. I think the big policy question is not, how you stop or control migration to urban areas. The big policy question is how you absorb and manage those new populations.
Right.
And do so in a way that's dynamic and synergistic.
That was Patrick Heller of Brown University. You also heard from Siddharth Swaminathan of the Institute for Social and Economic Change and Ramesh Ramanathan of the civil society organization Janagraha. This has been an Almira Radio feature on the Brown India Initiative's Citizenship Index project. Thank you for listening.